Well, good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's April 21st, 2021. We have two oral arguments on our calendar this morning before proceeding to our non-orals. So Marshall, will you call the first case?
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Jessen, Judge Ross, and Judge Smith. The Honorable Lucinda Jessen presiding. The first case this morning is A-20-0779, the State of Minnesota versus Rodney Donta Jackson.
Thank you. Well, as both of you know, the same basic rules apply here as in our physical courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your oral argument and counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'll ask you to each introduce yourself at the beginning of your arguments because we are recording and posting these arguments. If you have any trouble technically, or your screen freezes, just let us know. We'll stop, we'll try and deal with it. We'll stop the clock because we do really want to hear from both of you. So with that, counsel for appellant, we'll turn to you.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Julie Nelson and I represent the appellant, Rodney Jackson, in his appeal from his conviction for second degree intentional murder. Jackson raised three issues on appeal. But in the interest of time, I would like to focus primarily on issue two relating to the violation of Jackson's right to a public trial. This is an issue that has never been decided by our appellate courts. Of course, I will gladly address any questions that this court has regarding the other issues. Issue two asks whether the district court committed structural error when it closed the courtroom for the first day of the Schwartz hearing, when neither party requested the closure, Jackson objected to the closure, and the closure was unnecessary.
Can I pause you just for one moment, just with your headline statement? When you say the issue has never been decided by an appellate court, how narrowly are you defining the issue that's not been addressed by an appellate court?
Sure. So for the very first part of that, which is whether a defendant's Sixth Amendment right to a public trial extends to a Schwartz hearing, that is the very specific issue that has yet to be decided by either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court. And that would be even to answer issue two, there are four questions actually that this court will need to address. First, whether or not that Sixth Amendment right applies to Schwartz hearings, whether there was a total closure in this case, was the closure justified? And if not, what is the remedy? So with regard to the first part of that as to whether or not Sixth Amendment right to a public trial extends to a Schwartz hearing, the answer is emphatically yes. And we know that because the Minnesota Supreme Court has said public trial guarantee extends to all phases of the criminal trial, and this includes pretrial and post-verdict hearings. And a Schwartz hearing can actually occur, of course, either during a trial if there is some question about improper juror conduct, or certainly post-trial. And it is specifically contemplated within the rules. A Schwartz hearing is specifically contemplated within the rules of criminal procedure within the trial procedures itself. Under Minnesota Rule Criminal Procedure 26.03, it talks about Schwartz hearings occurring during the trial. In 26.04, it contemplates a post-verdict challenge to improper proceedings that occurred during the trial. In addition, a Schwartz hearing really does tick all the boxes of the type of hearing that does invoke the Sixth Amendment right. I urge this court to take a look at Justice Ross's concurring opinion in State v. Smith, where he said, when a criminal proceeding involves the presentation of witness testimony, the arguments of counsel or on a disputed question, or invocation of the court's fact-finding function, it's more likely to be subject to the requirements of the Sixth Amendment. And certainly a Schwartz hearing does all of those things.
Can you flesh out the state's challenge and the urging that we treat this as an administrative matter?
Yes, that was my next point. And that's exactly what the state is going to try to tell you to do, is that this is an administrative hearing. And with all due respect, the state is wrong. This is not an administrative hearing. An administrative hearing is something more along the lines of a scheduling hearing, a scheduling conference. And that's actually what was decided in Knorr, I believe, is that it was a scheduling conference that occurred in chambers that did not occur in the courtroom. And it was decided that really doesn't, the Sixth Amendment right to public trial doesn't really necessarily apply to that, something administrative like this. This is not administrative. We had witnesses, jurors testifying, the court making findings based on those findings. This is not an administrative hearing. And so I don't see any other answer, frankly, for this court other than to find that the Sixth Amendment right to a public trial does extend to a Schwartz hearing. And if the court does find so, then the next question is, was there a true closure? Well, there was, absolutely. There was a court order that came out that said, we're closing the courtroom. No one's allowed in except for the parties. The press was not allowed. Jackson's friends and family were not allowed. And neither was just the general public at all. The courtroom was truly closed. And there's quite a bit of discussion about it being closed. So this was a true closure. Then the question is whether or not the closure was justified. And once again, this court's going to have to look at several factors. And we're looking at the Waller factors. And there are four Waller factors that we would consider. Whether there's an overriding interest that is likely to be prejudiced, whether the closure was broader than necessary to protect that interest, and whether reasonable alternatives to closing the courtroom were considered. And then finally, whether the court made adequate findings to support the closure. Well, beginning with whether or not there's an overriding interest that is likely to be prejudiced, I would argue no. The court found that it needed to close the courtroom because of media attention, possible media attention at the first hearing that could then impact testimony at the second part of the Schwartz hearing, which would then impact Jackson's right to a fair trial.
Ms. Nelson, yes. Can I take you off your track one more time? Let's assume for a minute that we agreed with your argument in substance with regard to the Schwartz hearing. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to address the remedy. Why wouldn't a remand, I believe you'd like us to treat this as a matter that requires a new trial. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't a remand for a consideration of or reconsideration in open court of the portion of the Schwartz hearing that was closed be the remedy that's most fitting to the circumstances?
For several reasons, Your Honor. First of all, the remedy for a structural defect due to violation of defendant's constitutional right is a new trial. It's not a redo of the portion of the trial where the violation occurred.
Second, counsel, before we leave that point, mm-hmm. Waller was a case that came to the U.S. Supreme Court after conviction on RICO violations. The issue was a 7-day suppression hearing that the Supreme Court sent back to redo the suppression hearing.
Right.
Fully recognizing that you don't apply harmless error to evaluate whether the closure of the suppression hearing affected the outcome, but instead you redo that suppression hearing. So why do you cite, in your brief, you cited Waller and a Supreme Court case that cites Waller for the proposition that it's an automatic new trial, but Waller affirmatively rejected that.
Right. Well, if I may, the problem with trying to do that, that's the second part of this issue, is the practicality of redoing a Schwartz hearing here, it is impractical.
Why is it more impractical than a redo of a 7-day suppression hearing?
Well, because in this case, the jury deliberated on the subject, on the verdict, on October 31st, 2019 and October 1st, 2019. As of today, that is nearly 18 months ago. To bring the jury back now, to redo that would still be several months more out. And the question would be,
Hold on. Why does it differ from a pretrial hearing? We're still talking about evidence and facts and memories. I'm not sure. And by the way, when you switch from a constitutional argument to a practicality argument, I gather that you're conceding the point that is apparently made in Waller, which is that when the circumstances allow for it, though it may be deemed a structural error, a new trial is not necessarily necessary. You can address both of those questions if you would.
I am not conceding that a new trial is not necessary. And there's the practicality part of that argument simply is just an addition to the structural error part of this. If we call the jurors back now, 18 months plus 18 months later, then more than 18 months later, what would they be testifying about? Would they really be testifying about what they recall happening on October 31st and November 1st of 2019? Or would they be trying to remember what they testified to at the Schwartz hearing that occurred several months later? So that is extremely problematic. And in fact, the district court in this case found that delaying the Schwartz hearing until May or June of 2020, when all the jurors would be back in the country, that was too long for the jurors to bring the jurors back. So certainly 18 plus months later would be too long as well. As far as the suppression hearing in Waller goes, I would say that that's of a different nature than we're talking about when we're talking about questioning jurors about the validity of the verdict and whether or not the verdict was impeached.
Wait a second. We're questioning juries about the facts, not about the impact on the verdict. How does it differ from a simple factual inquiry about circumstances that may have led to a stop or a search?
I see your point, Your Honor, but it still goes to the impeachment of the actual verdict.
Well, that's the consequence, but the Schwartz hearing is only a fact finding, isn't it?
It is, much in the way that voir dire is fact finding. And in voir dire, we say that if there has not been an open trial, in fact, this court just decided that last week in Montoni, that if there's not an if the public trial right is not extended during voir dire, we don't do voir dire in open trial and then see how that goes. I mean, we're talking about voir dire and Schwartz hearing are far more connected and akin than a Schwartz hearing and a suppression hearing. In both voir dire and—
How so? In a voir dire, you're trying to establish the suitability of the juror to participate in the trial.
Correct.
In the Schwartz hearing, you're simply trying to determine whether the juror or jurors may have been influenced after the trial in their assessment of the evidence. Seems to me to be these are wholly different and easily separable.
But they are the only two hearings in which jurors are actually questioned. And when you're looking at voir dire, you are looking at whether or not they're suitable for the trial. You're looking at whether or not they can be fair to both parties. You're looking at whether or not they can follow the rules the court gives them. In a Schwartz hearing, you're essentially asking the same questions, but after they've been seated. Have you been fair? Did you follow the rule of the law of the court? Was there extraneous information? Was there misconduct? Were you fair to both parties? And that is far more like a voir dire than it is a suppression hearing, a pretrial suppression hearing, in terms of whether evidence is going to come in or not. And so the remedy needs to be a new trial in this case.
Why isn't suppression hearing more along the lines of a Schwartz hearing, since in both of those circumstances, without regard to who would be testifying, the question is the evidence that is offered, one being proper, one being improper evidence, whether it's constitutionally improper or undue influence improper. Why isn't that really the focus?
Well, I think that the other part of that would be with a suppression hearing, if you're talking about officers testifying, they would have their notes from the hearing, from what happened, from the stop. They would know, they would be able to refer back to that. They'd be able to refresh their recollection. Jurors can't do that. We don't have the same.
Jurors can't do what?
They wouldn't have reports from their deliberations. They would be having to refer specifically based on their recollection as to what happened 18 months ago with suppression hearing, which often sometimes suppression hearings happen long after a stop of an officer stops motor vehicle. They have their reports. They know what happened. There might even be video of it, a squad video. They can review it. They can refresh their recollection. You can't do that with a Schwartz hearing with jurors. They have to go completely on what they recall happening. And again, now we would have two different things that they would recall. One is what actually happened, and then what did they testify to?
So Ms. Nelson, I've tried to look at these cases, but I'm sure you know them better than I do. When we're trying to look at, you know, this question, you know, what would really remedy the violation? Would just a new Schwartz hearing remedy the violation as opposed to, or do we have to have a new trial? Do any of those cases look at the issue of like, well, did the trial judge already decided this? Can we unring that bell? I mean, I've seen some cases where the issue came to the courts on a writ of prohibition, for an example. That's a different context than here, it strikes me. Could you address that question for me?
Sure, if I understand it correctly. So with the court, so that's one of the Waller factors, is whether or not the court made sufficient findings to justify the closure. That's the fourth part about this. The court did make findings. I don't think that they were sufficient to justify the closure. In Minnesota, remand on the issue of closing of a courtroom, and if a courtroom has been closed, remand has been to have the court make findings with Waller. I mean, look at Peterson, for example. That's specifically what the remand was about, first time around. Remand to see if the Waller factors were met. Even in Montoni, this court considered doing a remand for findings because the district court did not do that, but then ultimately decided that the court would not be able to satisfy the Waller factors, and therefore a new trial was granted. I'm about to run out of time. May I have just a minute to finish addressing this?
Yes, and if you would, I was trying to get to the court's ultimate decision after the Schwartz hearing.
Right. So that this court will review that decision de novo. So you are not tied to the decision about, I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood. Are you talking about the actual, the decision of the Schwartz hearing, or whether or not there is a...
Yes, I was not talking about the fact about the findings. I understand that the judge did make findings here.
Right.
I was talking about when we're looking at kind of what would really remedy the violation, which is, I think, is one of the things we look at when we think about remedy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we've talked about the fact that, you know, the evidentiary challenges given the passage of time, and but is that really any different what happened in Waller? And I was asking if there are any cases that address the fact that, you know, here the district court has made a decision after the Schwartz hearing. As opposed to coming up to us or to the Supreme Court on a writ of prohibition in the middle of that, does that factor into whether or not sending it back for just another Schwartz hearing as opposed to a new trial remedies the violation?
And are you talking about in terms of whether or not the Schwartz hearing, the decision not to grant a new trial based on the Schwartz hearing, whether that has any play in this?
Yes, thank you for more succinctly putting my question than I did, Ms. Nelson.
Sorry, well, we have the two Schwartz issues going on. That as far as whether or not to grant a new Schwartz hearing based or new trial based on the Schwartz hearing and the findings of fact, that is abuse of discretion. And I argue that extensively in my brief why it isn't. But whether or not that affects what the remedy would be, I would say no, we're still going to go back to whether or not there was a closure. And if there was a closure that was not justified, regardless of what the findings of fact were, he gets a new trial.
Thank you for indulging.
So the case law on that would be, again, I would just refer this court to all the case law on voir dire, Peterson, Montoni. Those are cases where he gets a new trial. There was a closure.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Nelson. Does the panel have any further questions at this time? Thank you. We'll turn to you, Ms. Lawn.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, my name is Brittany Lawan, and I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota. The state respectfully requests that you reject appellant's arguments and affirm his conviction. Should this court conclude that it has been a closure and that it was an improper closure, the state would seek a remedy of redoing the Schwartz hearing. I would point, Judge Justin, you just requested whether or not the closure would adequately, like redoing it would adequately address that. And I would point you to the final paragraph in the Waller decision. If you look at pages 49 to 50, the Supreme Court says that in sending it back, the state can redo the suppression hearing. And if they alter the evidence presented, and if anything changes, then they might need a new trial. But if not, then there would be no need for a new trial. So I think the court there considered how even though it's going back to the same fact finder, it's remedied by having it publicly. And also, if nothing changes, then nothing changes and you don't go to the ultimate recourse of a new trial.
Ms. Lawan?
Yes.
Can I just interrupt you for a very minor issue? Can you move your microphone a little further away from your mouth? Because your peas are popping and it feels a little windy. So we could hear you a lot better.
Sorry about that.
No, that's okay. Sorry for the interruption.
Not at all. I would also turn to the question of practicality.
Before you do that, Go ahead. Finish. You were finishing your answer. So go ahead and do so. I have another question for you after you finish.
I was done with that answer. I was just going to turn to practicality with regard to the questions that you had actually asked, Your Honor.
Okay, that goes to remedy. Your proposition in your brief doesn't seem to be thoroughly supported from case law in Minnesota or elsewhere. This idea that a Schwartz hearing is just part of an administrative proceeding. What is the strong, there are maybe not called Schwartz hearings, but hearings all over the country, like our Schwartz hearing. And I cannot imagine that you would assert that it's administrative only unless you find it, you found a case to support it. Were you able to find one?
Your Honor, I was not. And in doing research, further research, and especially after the Knorr decision, as well as Justice Sotomayor's dissent in the Byron White case, I don't believe that I can say that it's administrative anymore. And so I would concede that it's not administrative in nature. But I don't think that that leads us to automatically granting a new trial. And I would note that in some of the cases cited, I believe, in Ms. Nelson's reply brief, there's discussion about Second Circuit case law and other circuits in which they have given it to the discretion of the district court whether to conduct questions in chamber and in camera with jurors. Obviously, those are not binding on this court. And the majority of cases that I have found have dealt with the First Amendment issue, and then whether or not the press can intervene in the case, and then what the remedy would be there. And in those cases, the remedy was to kind of redo the hearing. It wasn't a criminal appeal, so it's not quite as applicable, but it seems this is an undeveloped area of law.
Can I take you back even further, just to a very basic fundamental question, which I think is assumed in your brief, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. Whether the court appropriately closed the court. That seems to be a matter of concession. Am I right that you're not defending the district court's decision to close the courtroom. You're only asserting that it is not a Sixth Amendment right to have the courtroom open. Have I misread your brief?
Possibly. I am defending the decision to close. I think here that because of the limited nature in the fact that there were two jurors, it was 16 pages of trial transcripts and I believe 25 minutes. And due to the limited nature and the alternatives that were considered by the court, I believe that this was a proper closure. However, should this court conclude otherwise, the appropriate remedy is to remand back for a redo of the Schwartz hearing with those two jurors. And with regard to the practicality of that, I would point this court to a 2018 decision on a case, and it's not cited in my brief. And Ms. Nelson, the site is 2018 Westlaw 3966342, State versus Crenshaw. It's a case that I argued before this court and Judge Ross, you authored, in which there was a Schwartz hearing, a mini Schwartz hearing that was conducted that this court found not to be enough. And so this court remanded for a Schwartz hearing, which took place 2 years after the fact. And that was not a concern at that time. It was more a matter of actually having that hearing that preempted the concern of the delay in time.
Ms. Lawton, I just want to be really clear. Mm-hmm. We find that there's a violation, the Sixth Amendment violation, you're no longer saying, but the transcript is enough to remedy this, correct?
Correct, Your Honor, because I don't have a case that supports that. I pointed to that noting that it is structural error, but the remedy is not automatically a new trial. We know happened.
And I just want to try and be clear about what we're arguing about. And you're not saying, we'll just go back then and redo those two jurors. You're saying if there is a problem, redo the entire Schwartz hearing. Is that Am I clear about that?
No, Your Honor, and I apologize if I'm not being clear. What I'm saying is the transcript is not enough. I think it does show that there wasn't prejudice, but I concede that this is not a question of whether or not prejudice applies because of the amendment that we're dealing with. However, because only the first portion of the Schwartz hearing was closed, to remedy that problem would be to go back and have those two jurors testify, only the closed portion. The other jurors would not be required to come in because that portion of the hearing was open.
Can you address the practicality argument?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's why I point to Crenshaw, because it is true that memories fade over time and that there are lay individuals who don't take police reports, who aren't testifying at a suppression hearing about things, just like there are lay witnesses who testify to things that they saw and experienced in a trial. And I think that this is limited in the sense of it's a question of whether something was brought up in jury deliberations, not the effect it had. And these two jurors have already testified that, yes, it was brought up. In fact, one of the jurors in this closed Schwartz hearing was the juror who brought it up. She's the juror who actually put on the questionnaire, this should have been discussed and I brought it up. So I think this isn't going to be an issue of whether or not they remember it. They already have remembered it, and the court can perhaps, with carefully worded instructions from this court on remand, explain what the purpose of the hearing is, and then the jurors can say what happened, what they remembered, and that's it. They would not go into the province of the deliberations. It would be limited as it was and as it was properly limited the first time around.
Can we turn to the question of whether it was a closure, you acknowledge it's a true closure. The question then is whether it's a justified closure. Can you speak to the question of why this closure was justified? And does it, how is it different from other situations where there might be reporting on a case or you might have witnesses come in at different times? What justified doing it, and how does the defense's desire to have the hearings together so as not to taint the witnesses factor into this decision by the district court, if at all?
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. And thank you for mentioning that. That it is true that defense counsel did suggest initially that they should be held separately so that there would not be an impact on the other jurors, or that they should have it together and delay it. However, because he later objected, I don't believe that we're at a plain error process under Benton. If you disagree with me, that's fine. However, I think that his objection later clarifies that. I do think that in looking at the reason for the closure was because there was going to be jurors who were gone for a long time, and because of the practicality concerns of trying to get the information as soon as possible. I understand that on remand, that sounds a little trying to have it both ways, saying that that's not an issue. However, the judge looking at it at that time wanted to get the information. This was before sentencing. The judge was trying to move the case forward and trying to figure out if they needed to redo the entire trial. Also, this is different from other voir dire cases where that's in the middle of trial during jury selection and things of that nature. This is after verdict. This is a different type of Schwartz hearing because it's inquiring into whether something improperly went into the consideration. It's not inquiring into misconduct conducted during the trial before deliberations had begun.
But why close the first hearing? Why close it? Acknowledging that you could have separate ones and the defense wanted them both open, what justifies closing the first one?
The district court's conclusion that it was justified because there was a possibility that what those jurors said would be released would then impact the testimony of the other jurors. And I recognize that that is not something, I mean, we just had an entire trial that was broadcast. Like this is not a nature where an individual, every single trial might be, the details of it might be in the paper and those jurors might see it. But there was an instance here where one of the jurors actually contacted the judge because they had heard before the subpoenas were sent out that they'd be called back. So I think the court was trying to be cautious about it here.
But I just don't see how that justification leads to closure that excludes Jackson's friends and relatives. I mean, isn't this overly broad, which gets us beyond being justified?
And if it is overly broad in that sense, then the appropriate remedy is to remand it. And here, perhaps it would be difficult for the court to exclude the press, but then to allow other individuals to be there, because that's a partial closure, but it's unlike other cases where this court has affirmed or the Supreme Court has affirmed where there've been incidences of threatening a witness or something like that. That I don't think that the court could pick and choose who could be present here. They were going to close it completely or they were going to have it be open. And there was the consideration of subpoenaing these jurors to make them comply with the court subpoena. They had been subpoenaed. There was a thought by the judge that perhaps she would enforce those subpoenas, even though someone I believe was going to be overseas. And she decided, and I think it was properly limited, that this was a more reasonable alternative. However, if this court disagrees, I respectfully would request that it be remanded to address those two jurors and to ensure that it's done in open court. Unless there are further questions from the court, I would respectfully rely on my brief and ask that you affirm. Thank you.
Are there additional questions from the panel? Thank you. Ms. Nelson, we will turn to you for rebuttal.
Thank you. Can you hear me? Okay. So a couple of things that were, first of all, I would like to address again, Judge Jessen, your question about whether or not the findings on the Schwartz hearing would have any impact on the remand. I think that it would, as I was thinking about this.
The judge has already made her decision on this. What's the likelihood that we put this in front of a public trial? We put this in, we redo those two jurors in a public setting and that she's going to change her mind. I think that what happens by doing that is we are simply putting a Band-Aid on a structural defect in the trial.
Well, distinguish Waller in that concern. Same thing could be said of a district court's decision in a suppression hearing, can it?
Well, I think you're right, Your Honor. It could be, but this is not a suppression hearing. I would also point out that no Minnesota courts have never remanded on a structural error just to correct that structural error. I mean, so for example, with voir dire, we've had, again, just recently in Montoni and then in Peterson, we didn't remand to redo voir dire and then just keep the verdict the way it was. This is even more important than what happens in voir dire because this goes to specifically to whether or not the verdict was impeached.
Well, going back to practicality, there is an underlying reason why fundamental errors are treated as structural errors, and that prejudice need not be shown.
Right.
And in this case, I'm not sure those principles apply when it's an post-trial concerns about influence on the jurors or evidence that might have impacted the jury. I can see it certainly is apparent why, in the case of an individual who's denied right to counsel, that of course you don't need to show structural, you don't need to show prejudice because prejudice is presumed when an individual has to defend a case without an attorney. Or if the trial itself were held in private, then in closed doors, the concern may be that jurors would testify differently if they thought the trial had occurred publicly. So structural error makes sense, and applying the no need to show prejudice approach makes perfect sense. I'm not sure that it makes sense in this case. Disabuse me of my concern.
Well, and you are correct in this case that the hearing was post-trial, but the misconduct occurred during the trial, and that's what the hearing was about. So when you say that this was all post-verdict, it wasn't, because the question was what happened in reaching the verdict, which happened during the trial, right? Whether or not this extraneous information came in and affected the verdict of the other jurors, or how it affected how the verdict was arrived at. That's the question that was addressed during the Schwartz hearing. The Schwartz hearing itself was post-verdict, but the misconduct would have occurred during the deliberations, which was certainly pre-verdict.
But I'm not sure how that advances the point. I mean, if the question at the Schwartz hearing is what information did the jurors receive, and that hearing takes place after the fact, why would a structural error approach to the remedy of the typical remedy of a new trial and a structural error approach would be fitting? I'm not sure how those principles apply here. I don't know that your answer quite gets there.
I'm going to refer this court back to the voir dire. Why do we not simply go back and remand for voir dire to take place, call back jurors who had been struck or had been, whether they struck or not, but had been questioned outside of a public trial? Why don't we just bring them back and re-question them?
Well, I think you've just answered the question. I mean, the idea that it's a structural error, we don't bring them back to re-question them because in that circumstance, the concern that jurors aren't, that witnesses don't act the same when it's public versus closed impacts the trial going forward. Not so in a Schwartz hearing where there's no further impact to be had. The answer to the question is either accurate or not. I don't know if my response is.
But this absolutely could have affected. Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt, Your Honor. But this absolutely could have impacted what the testimony was of those jurors because it was not a public trial. The juror who brought up the concern wrote one thing in reevaluation and kind of testified to something else, and it was a closed hearing. Now, excuse me, may I just finish this? Thank you. had it been public, would she have changed that decision or what she testified to? We don't know. That's the problem. And to call her back now and ask her to do it in public, what's the likelihood that she's going to testify differently again? We don't know, but maybe she's going to try to just recreate what she had said during the first hearing, because otherwise it would be inconsistent. This was a structural error. Structural error requires a new trial. We request very respectfully that this court does vacate Mr. Jackson's conviction and give him a new trial. Thank you.
Judge Smith.
Can I ask one question? I want to go to the, you argue in your brief that there was no, that the district court finding that there was an overriding interest is erroneous. And I appreciate the state's argument and your argument that, I mean, of course, this isn't a plain air situation. There was an objection made to closing the courtroom. However, I want to understand how the defense's perspective goes to the overriding interest question, because the defense was in the hearing when they're talking about what to do with the Schwartz hearing. The defense is arguing that it would be prejudicial. To have, it says, because a Schwartz hearing would be public, the court doesn't have the ability to prevent jurors from reading about it, doesn't have the ability to prevent jurors from talking about it. So there's no way to control exposure of the jurors to questioning. And so it's prejudicial. So it seems like an interest was being raised by the defense about the possibility of exposure that was uncontrollable. So why isn't that why is the district court wrong then to recognize the concern about tainting the testimony as an interest?
Well, for a couple of reasons. The defendant, Jackson, objected to the bifurcation of the Schwartz hearing. And it was in that specific context that he raised a concern about media coverage. But once the court said this is going to be a bifurcated hearing, Jackson made the decision that having a public trial was more important to him. And so he reordered his preferences at that point and what he wanted. And he can do that. He has the right. The right belongs to Jackson. In addition to which, it's not just that it has to be an overriding interest. It has to be an overriding interest that's likely to be prejudiced. It's very possible that any negative impact that was going to occur had already occurred because there was a Star Tribune article out there, apparently. So that might have already been out there. But again, if we're looking at what else the court could have done, all sorts of things. I mean, again, if we look at the trial that just concluded, we have lots of witnesses who testified and have no doubt admonished to not pay attention to anything that might be in the media, international attention, and the court never closed the courtroom. So even if there was an interest that was likely to be prejudiced, which again, I argue there wasn't, but even if there was, there certainly was a very simple remedy for that.
Is that further questions from the panel? Well, thank you both very much for your helpful arguments. The court will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you.